following was delivered at Antioch Presbyterian Church, located in Woodruff, South Carolina. For more information about Antioch Presbyterian Church, please visit antiochpca.com or contact us at info@antiochpca.com. May the Lord bless you as you receive gracious instruction from His Word. The following is a recording of Whatsoever Things Are True, Classic Discourses on Truth by Dr. James Henley Thornwell. Discourse 2, The Love of Truth. The injunction of the apostle to think on whatsoever things are true obviously implies that the love of truth for its own sake is a habit which we are bound to cultivate and cherish. If it is a circumstance of their being true which entitles these things to our attention and regard, and makes it our duty to investigate and pursue them, there must be something in truth, essentially considered, which commends it to the moral approbation of the species. It is to be regretted that philosophers, in commenting upon the obligation of veracity, have not paid sufficient attention to the habit or general disposition of the soul which lies at the foundation of every form of the virtue, of accuracy in narrative, sincerity in conduct, and fidelity to engagements. Commentators have even gone so far as to maintain that the apostle in the words before us had his eye only upon that species of truth which relates to the social intercourse of men, taking it for granted that this is the only kind of truth to which an ethical character pertains. One, note Dr. Watts' sermon on Philippians 4:8, represents him as describing, quote, moral characters and the duties of a Christian, end quote, and accordingly restricts his meaning to, quote, integrity and uprightness in opposition to hypocrisy, insincerity, or moral falsehood, end quote. The conviction seems to be common that the operations of the understanding are not immediately under the cognizance of conscience, and that of the processes by which we form our speculative opinions, virtue and vice can neither be affirmed or denied. These speculations are often directed to subjects in their own nature indifferent, and it is confidently inferred that because the objects of our thoughts have nothing to do with the distinctions of morality, our thoughts themselves are equally exempt from a moral character. Hence has arisen the dogma that we are not responsible for our opinions. The understanding is treated as a series of faculties subject to its own laws, moving in a peculiar and restricted sphere, having no other connection with conscience than as it analyzes and applies the rules of morality to the cases of practice which are constantly occurring in the business of the world. It may study, arrange, and digest the moral code, but the laws which it acknowledges have no reference to its own processes, but only to the conduct of life. This, however, is not the doctrine of the Scriptures. They represent the domain of morality as extending to the whole nature of man. Whatever directly or indirectly falls under the jurisdiction of the will possesses an ethical character, and may be the occasion to us of praise or blame, according to the principles and habits by which we have been governed. The morality does not attach to the processes or faculties themselves, but to the spirit and temper, the motives and purposes which have shaped and determined their operations. There is a general sense in which all the elements of our spiritual nature are in subjection to the will. The springs of action in our appetites, affections, and desires with which we are endowed all act blindly. They simply impel, but they do not direct. They cannot regulate their own motions. They cannot prescribe the extent or circumstances of their gratification or determine the relative value of the objects which elicit them. They rouse the will, and that must consult the conscience and the understanding as the course to be pursued. Corresponding to all those springs of action, there are moral laws in obedience to which the will must control them. These laws, ingrained into the nature and invested with the supremacy which belongs to them, are so many habits of virtue, the complement of which makes up integrity of character. In the springs of action themselves, there is nothing directly virtuous or vicious. They are simply indifferent. It is when they have put the man in the attitude of motion that responsibility begins, and according to the principles upon which he treats them, he is entitled to praise or blame. These motive impulses are adjusted to the whole nature of man. Some spring from the body and operate at periodic intervals, such as hunger and thirst, the appetite of sex and the desire of repose. There is nothing virtuous or vicious in any of the naked appetites, but virtue and vice may attach to the methods of their gratification. There may be excess, as in gluttony and drunkenness. Food may be unlawfully procured or may consist of materials prejudicial to the health of the system. Other springs of action are directed to the mind, among which one of the most prominent is curiosity or the desire of knowledge. In this also there is nothing directly moral, but an ethical character ensues the very moment the will pronounces upon the manner, the ends, and the extent of its gratification. When the question arises, how shall this desire of knowledge be gratified? There are moral laws in conformity with which the will is compelled to decide. Other springs of action are directed to the nurture and cultivation of the finer affections of the heart, and like those already enumerated, are indifferent in themselves, though the modes and measure and objects of their indulgence are equally subject to the jurisdiction of the conscience. As then there are principles of action designed to stimulate every department of our nature, and as the method and an extent of their operation are to be determined by the moral understanding, every department of man's nature is brought under the cognizance of moral law, and he may be virtuous or vicious on account of his opinions and sentiments as well as on account of his conduct. The law in conformity with which we are bound to regulate the impulses of curiosity is the love of truth. This law, written upon the heart, incorporated into the nature, strengthened into a habit, constitutes the measure of the morality of intellect. It is not merely an accomplishment, an excellence, a beauty. It is an indispensable duty to aim at truth in all the excursions of the understanding. It is as much a moral obligation to seek for it in our opinions as to express it in our words or to manifest it in our conduct. We are responsible for the opinions which we form, not merely as these opinions are connected with conduct or are probably the offspring of corrupt affections, but on the ground that the love of truth, in the whole extent and variety of its import, is an imperative and indestructible duty. This is the uniform teaching of the Scriptures. This is implied in the exhortation to buy the truth and sell it not, to seek that wisdom which is only another name for it as for hidden treasures, and to prefer its merchandise to that of gold and silver. Jesus Christ commends himself to our confidence in love on the ground of his being the truth, promised the Holy Spirit as the Spirit of truth, denounced the vengeance of God upon those who believed him not when he had told them the truth, and makes it the glory of the Father that he is the God of truth, and the shame and everlasting infamy of the Prince of Darkness that he is the father of lies. The eulogies directly and indirectly bestowed in the Scriptures upon truth, knowledge, understanding, wisdom, have special reference, we freely concede, to that department of truth which is the immediate subject of divine revelation. But they would be evidently pointless and meaningless if truth in general were not intrinsically a good, and a good of such a nature as to lay the understanding under a formal obligation to receive it. It is indeed, as the ancients well expressed it, the food of the soul, pabulum animi. There is a natural congruity betwixt it and the structure of the mind. The one corresponds to the other as light to the eye and sounds to the ear. The existence of such a desire as curiosity is a clear intimation that man was formed for intelligence as well as for action, and the adjustment of his faculties to the objects by which he is surrounded is a command from God to exercise them according to the laws by which he has defined their operation in the acquisition of knowledge. Aristotle, note, Nicomachean Ethics, end note, having divided the rational faculties of man into speculative and practical, proceeds to determine what is the best habit of each. The best habit of anything, he denominates its virtue, and very justly observes that the virtue of each object is ascertained by its fitness for performing its peculiar functions. These faculties evidently point to truth, the one speculative, the other practical, as their appropriate function, and hence are a call of God through the essential constitution of the mind to seek for wisdom. This doctrine seems to me to be expressly and directly taught in a passage of the Eudemian Ethics, note, Book 7, Chapter 14, quoted in Hamilton's Read, page 773, end note, which has been the occasion of not a little perplexity to the commentators. The Stagirite there makes God the principle of motion in the human soul, and treats the fundamental deliverances of consciousness as inspirations of the Almighty, more certain than any deductions of science or reason, and as the conditions upon which all subsequent knowledge depends. God has made us cognitive beings. He has impressed upon us necessary and indestructible laws of belief, and if there be any force in the argument from final causes, we are obliged to regard the pursuit of knowledge as a part of the law of our being. It is the end of the mind to know, as it is of the eye to see, the ear to hear, or the heart to feel. Every man is as distinctly organized in reference to truth as in reference to any other purpose. It deserves farther to be remarked that it is the prerogative of truth alone to invigorate the mind. The distinctions of sophistry and error may impart acuteness, quicken sagacity, and stimulate readiness, but what is gained in sharpness is lost in expansion and solidity. The minuteness of vision which falls to the lot of whole tribes of insects is suited only to a narrow sphere and to diminutive objects. The eye, which can detect the latent animalcules which teem in the air, the water, and the soil, is incompetent to embrace in its range the glories of heaven or the beauties of earth. The dexterity and readiness which defenses of falsehood are suited to produce is not a free, generous, healthful activity, but a diseased condition of the system analogous to that induced by fever or poisonous and stimulating potions. But truth is a food which the soul digests. It strengthens and consolidates the mind, and is in every view worthy of the high encomiums which the ancient sages were accustomed to lavish upon the pursuits of their favorite philosophy as the wealth of reason, the culture and medicine of the soul, the choicest gift of heaven. There is another aspect in which the love of truth, as the pervading law of our speculative inquiries, may be satisfactorily exhibited. The moral and intellectual natures of man are so intimately connected, their mutual dependence so nicely adjusted, their action and reaction so perfect and complete, that confusion of understanding is always accompanied with corresponding lubricity of principle, and he whose perceptions of truth are not remarkable for clearness and precision will most surely be distinguished by an equal obscurity in his conceptions of rectitude. The moral duties which we are required to perform may be contemplated as speculative principles whose truth must be submitted to the decision of reason, as well as authoritative laws of the conscience whose precepts we are bound to obey. There must be an exercise of the reflective understanding in eliminating the primary dicta of our moral nature, and in determining the occasions and circumstances which call for the application of particular rules. The regulation of our conduct is not dependent upon instinct. Aristotle, among the ancients, was unquestionably in advance of every age which preceded the introduction of Christianity, and is still in advance of many who call themselves Christians, in his clear and steady perception of the indissoluble connection betwixt the cogitative and practical departments of man's nature in reference to duty. He treats it as a distinction betwixt virtue and science that the latter is restricted to one portion of the soul, while the former embraces all the elements of our being. Quote, there are three principles, quote, he affirms in the Nicomachean Ethics, quote, which either single or combined are the sovereign judges of truth and conduct. These are sensation, intellect, and appetite. Of these three, mere sensation cannot alone be the foundation of any judgment respecting the conduct, that is, the propriety of action, for wild beasts have perception by sense, but are totally unacquainted with propriety. Affirming and denying are the operations of intellect, desire and aversion are those of appetite, and since moral virtue implies a habit of just election, and election or preference resolves itself into deliberation and appetite, every act of virtuous preference requires that there should be accuracy and truth in the comparison, as well as correctness and propriety in the desire." End quote. In conformity with this reasoning, he subsequently denominates the moral election or preference peculiar to man, quote, an impassioned intelligence or reflecting appetite, end quote. Who is not reminded of Bishop Butler's, quote, sentiment of the understanding or perception of the heart, end quote? The investigation of duty involving so obviously the exercise of judgment, those philosophers are not to be rashly condemned, who attribute the power of distinguishing betwixt right and wrong to the same faculty of the mind, which, it is confessed, distinguishes betwixt truth and falsehood. They feel that the mental processes are so nearly identical that they cannot but regard it as an unnecessary multiplication of original powers to have a peculiar understanding conversant only about moral truth, while another understanding is admitted to exist which deals in truth of every other kind. Our faculties, which are only convenient names for the various operations of a simple and indivisible substance, derive their appellation not from the specific differences of the objects about which they are employed, but from their general nature. The discovery of truth, it is maintained, is as much an end to the moral inquirer who is seeking, under given circumstances, to determine his duty, as it is to the physical philosopher, whose investigations cannot be legitimately pushed beyond the province of existing phenomena. The same laws of evidence, the same original principles, the same elements of human belief, and the same process of patient analysis and patient induction are, or ought to be, common to both, and can no more be discarded with impunity by the one than they can be by the other. This reasoning is certainly plausible, though not conclusive. There is judgment in the decisions of the conscience, and the laws, in conformity with which that faculty pronounces what Kant calls its categorical imperative, become standards of evidence, the constitutive and regulative principles of operation in all that pertains to rectitude and duty. Mere speculation could never suggest to us the notions of right and wrong, of virtue or a crime. But the materials which conscience supplies become the subjects of philosophic contemplation and are worked up in the laboratory of reflection into abstract principles which must react upon the conscience. The moral opinions framed by the understanding from the phenomena of conscience will constitute our code of right, and in the application of this code to the countless contingencies and diversified occasions of life, there is room for the influence of judgment in determining what principles to apply. There can consequently be no progress in virtue beyond the merest elements or primary dicta of our moral constitution without progress in intelligence. Knowledge is as essential to responsibility as conscience. Hence, a variable or fluctuating standard of truth necessarily introduces a variable and fluctuating standard of morals. Whatever system legitimates error, legitimates crime. Whatever blinds the understanding, corrupts the heart. The moral nature, developed side by side with the intellectual, and in a large measure dependent upon it, is always involved in the same ruin. Rude and barbarous nations are as much indebted to imbecility of reason, superinduced by neglect of cultivation, false associations, or ill-judged discipline for their mistaken apprehensions of good and evil and the practical details of life, as to depravity of taste or perversion of moral sensibility. Their deeds of darkness are performed without compunctious visitings of conscience, not because that messenger of God slumbers in the breast, or is bribed by the sinner to hold its peace, or prevaricates in regard to the fundamental distinctions of right and wrong, but because that light is extinguished, that soundness of judgment is wanting, without which it is impossible to discriminate in the cases presented. The moral habits can no more expand nor take root downwards and bear fruit upwards, while the understanding, the true sun of the intellectual system, is veiled in darkness, than the plants and herbage of nature can flourish in beauty and luxuriance without the genial light of the day. The sense of obligation is always just in proportion to the enlargement of the mind with liberal views of the relations of mankind, and although the knowledge of the right does not necessarily secure its practice, it does secure what is always of vast importance to society, remorse to the guilty, and a homage of respect to the good. He that acknowledges a legitimate standard of moral obligation will find in his conscience a check to those crimes which, through weakness, he is unable to suppress, a restraint upon those passions which, through frailty, cannot be subdued. The transgressor who violates rules of unquestioned authority which his own understanding has deduced from the phenomena of conscience will assuredly drive tranquility from his bosom and repose from his couch. He sins indeed, but without that moral hardihood which attaches to those who, in their blindness and ignorance, put light for darkness and bitter for sweet. They are the most dangerous offenders who tamper with the principles of rectitude itself, who seek to escape the reproaches of conscience by degrading the standard of moral obligation, who pursue peace at the expense of truth and extinguish the light that they may not behold the calamity of their state. The abandoned condition of the Gentile world, which the Apostle graphically describes in the first chapter of the Epistle to the Romans, is ultimately traced to the vanity of their thoughts and the darkness of their minds. And those to whom the gospel is hid have their minds blinded by the God of this world, lest the light of the glorious gospel of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine into them and reveal the glory of the Lord, by the contemplation of which they might be transformed into the same image from glory to glory. There is hope of reformation as long as the principles remain uncorrupted, but when the light which is in us is converted into darkness, when lies are greedily embraced and errors deliberately justified, the climax of guilt has been reached, the ruin of the character is complete, and the perdition of the soul, without a stupendous miracle of grace, seems to be inevitable. Shame and remorse, the usual channels through which amendment is produced, are always the result of consciousness of wrong, an affection which is utterly inconsistent with that complete degradation of the mind into which thousands have been sunk, and in which error is neither lamented nor admitted. From the intimate alliance which subsists betwixt the understanding and the conscience, speculative falsehood must be fatal to the integrity of morals. He who trifles with the constitution of his nature in those primary convictions which lie at the foundation of all knowledge and philosophy, an error must be ultimately traced to some transgression of their laws, is cherishing a temper which shall soon rise in rebellion against the authority of conscience and extinguish the only light that can convict him of crime. From the obscurity and confusion which have been permitted to shroud the understanding may be anticipated a deeper gloom which is soon to settle on the heart. That the moral conduct of men is not always answerable to the looseness of their speculative principles is not to be ascribed to any redeeming virtue in the principles themselves, but to the restraints of society and the voice of nature which licentiousness has not yet been able to suppress. The tendency exists, though accidental hindrances have retarded its development. The denial of the reality of truth and evidence will be attended with a corresponding denial of rectitude and sin. These remarks, though they appear to me to be intuitively obvious, are felt to be necessary in order to rebuke the growing impression that speculative principles have no immediate influence in regulating conduct. We live in an age of sophists. A man may believe anything or nothing, and yet if his actions are consistent with the standard of public decency, his principles are not to be condemned, and he is not to be charged with wickedness on account of them. In the formation of his opinions, he is exempt from the moral law. Conscience takes cognizance of nothing but the life. As if there could be any real virtue where practice is not the result of principle. As if the opinion were not the soul, life, and being of all that is praiseworthy or excellent in the conduct. There can be no morality without intelligence. And if there exists in the bosom of the Almighty an eternal standard of truth from which the law of righteousness proceeds, in conformity with which the arrangements of providence are conducted and the relations of things adjusted, and by which alone the harmony of the world can be effectually promoted, the first step towards communion with the Father of Lights is to recognize that standard and to have its rays reflected upon our own consciences. The mind cannot move in charity nor rest in providence unless it turn upon the poles of truth. Quote, the inquiry of truth, end quote, says Bacon, note, Essay on Truth, end note, quote, which is the love-making or wooing of it, the knowledge of truth, which is the presence of it, and the belief of truth, which is the enjoying of it, is the sovereign good of human nature. The first creature of God in the work of days was the light of sense. The last was the light of reason. And his Sabbath work ever since is the illumination of his spirit. End quote. The last consideration, which I shall adduce in order to show the ethical character of the love of truth as a pervading law of intellectual speculations, is a circumstance that it is the general habit of mind of which honesty, frankness, sincerity, and faithfulness are only specific manifestations. There is no method of argument by which the obligation of veracity in the ordinary intercourse in business life can be established which will not equally apply to the doctrine in question. Whatever evinces the wickedness and sin of voluntarily imposing upon others will evince with equal certainty the wickedness and sin of voluntarily imposing upon ourselves. We have no more right to deceive ourselves than we have to deceive our neighbors. That state of the understanding in which it is exempt from prejudice and judges according to the light of evidence is only a different manifestation of that general condition of the soul in which it rejoices in rectitude, delights in sincerity, and scorns every approximation to concealment or hypocrisy. Few are sensible of the close alliance which subsists between partiality to error and duplicity and fraud in conduct. They are shoots from the same stock, fruits of the same tree. He that lies to his own understanding, or what amounts to the same thing, does not deliberately propose to himself truth as the end of all his investigations, will not scruple at deceit with his neighbors. He that prevaricates in matters of opinion is not to be trusted in matters of interest. The love of truth is honesty of reason, as the love of virtue is honesty of heart. And so impossible is it to cultivate the moral affections at the expense of the understanding that they who receive not the truth in the love of it are threatened in the scriptures with the most awful malediction that can befall a sinner in this sublunary state, an eclipse of the soul and a blight upon the heart, which are the certain forerunners of the second death. The spirit of leasing is always one. What in regard to speculative opinions we denominate sophistry is a species of the same general habit which developed into actions gives birth to the character of the knave, distinguished from the man of probity and wisdom, not more by the meanness of his views and the littleness of his ends than the number and minuteness of his contrivances to reconcile villainy with fair appearances. The sophist of speculation is the hypocrite of practice. The same temper which prompts us to prevaricate on one subject will prompt us to prevaricate on all. As the soul is one and indivisible, and understanding, affections, memory, and will are only terms expressive of conditions in which the same substance is successively found, or forms of action which the same substance successively puts forth, whatever indicates disease in one mode of operation must, from the simplicity of its nature, affect it in all. As in music, it is the same key which pervades the tune, whatever may be the variety of notes of which it is composed, so there is a general tone of mind which distinguishes all its activities and gives harmony, consistency, and unity to its various processes in every department of thought and feeling. There is a characteristic complexion, a pervading temper, which may be found alike in the tenor of its opinions, the trains of its reasoning, and the sentiments of the heart. If that temper be the love of truth, The whole man will be distinguished by candor, sincerity, openness, and generosity. If the spirit of Li Xing, the whole man will be distinguished by duplicity, treachery, equivocation, and concealment. The love of truth is, accordingly, the great moral law in conformity with which curiosity must be regulated. It is the morality of the intellectual man, being to the understanding what sincerity is to the heart. The only plausible objection which can be sustained against the conclusiveness of these views, which bring the understanding under the control of conscience and subject the motives to intellectual effort to the jurisdiction of morality, is that which assumes that the operations of the mind in the department of speculative truth are exempt from the authority of the will. Reed was unquestionably right in the announcement, which, as far as I know, he was the first distinctly and broadly to make, that virtue and vice are impossible where there is no exercise of the will. It has accordingly been contended by philosophers of no less note than Sir James Mackintosh, Lord Brougham, and the author of Essays on the Formation of Opinions, that as the assent of the understanding is always involuntary, being the necessary result of the evidence submitted to its view, no moral character can attach to our opinions. We cannot, on account of them, be either the subjects of praise or blame, of reward or punishment. But one, they tell us, who has mastered the successive links in a chain of mathematical reasoning, the conclusion can no more be resisted than light can be excluded from the open eye. The design of these illustrious men in maintaining the innocence of opinion is worthy of all praise, but they have certainly confounded questions that are entirely distinct. Their purpose was to lay a broad basis for civil toleration and for mutual charity. They wish to transfer opinions from the jurisdiction of the magistrate and to rebuke the clamors of bigotry, intolerance, and sectarian zeal. For this purpose, however, it was not necessary to prove that man is not responsible for his opinions at all, but only that he is not responsible to his fellows. Persecution is not the offspring of the doctrine that responsibility attaches to opinion, but that this responsibility is directed to the magistrate. The scriptures consequently put responsibility upon its proper ground when they show that though we are responsible only to God. We are not the masters of each other's faith. We are not at liberty to judge or despise our brother in consequence of his differences from us, but still each man must give account of himself to God. He may sin in his opinions, but we are not the persons to punish him for his guilt. To his own master he stands or falls. These remarks are made in order to guard against the impression that in combating the argument for toleration, we are opposed to the principle of toleration itself. On the contrary, it seems to us that the philosophers in question have left it in a much more precarious condition than they found it. But to pass this over, the same method of argument to which they have resorted in this case might be employed with equal pertinency and force to prove that there is no responsibility for the emotions, affections, or permanent conditions of the heart. Love and hate are as much beyond the immediate province of the will as doubt or belief. These passions depend upon the presence or conception of qualities which just as necessarily excite them as evidence produces conviction. Even the determinations of the will itself are not exempt from the influence of the great law of causation, and if the argument is pushed to the extent of its legitimate application, conduct will be as lawless as opinion. The connection betwixt motives and action is not less intimate and necessary than that between evidence and faith. It is precisely because there is this connection that responsibility in either case becomes conceivable or possible. If evidence had no inherent and essential tendency to generate belief, if conviction were the arbitrary offspring of circumstances, why should we be bound to examine evidence at all? And if motives had no inherent and essential tendency to terminate in conduct, why should we be bound to cultivate right affections? Let those who hope to escape from responsibility by resorting to metaphysical distinctions beware that they are not entangled in their own net, and that in the issue they do not establish what they are trying to overthrow. The fallacy, however, of this popular argument is easily detected. It consists in restricting the application of the will to the final determination to act, in making will synonymous with volition. But when morality is confined to the province of the will, that faculty is made to embrace all the wishes and desires, all the appetites and habits which constitute the springs of human action. Morality prescribes to them their laws, and whenever these active principles are indulged in contravention of those laws, there guilt necessarily ensues. Whenever in obedience to those precepts, there virtue and rectitude obtain. The sole question, therefore, is whether vicious propensities and desires have any influence upon the operations of the mind, whether good or bad emotions can exert any sway in directing its efforts and giving shape to its results. The answer here is too obvious to be denied. The illustrations derived from mathematical demonstration are singularly unfortunate. The reasonings of necessary science are subject to none of those disturbing influences which, as we shall subsequently see, the mind experiences in practical inquiries from its tastes, its temper, and its prejudices. There is in this case no colored glass to tinge the light as it passes to the eye. Besides, the contradictory of a necessary truth is not only false but absurd, and to entertain it or even to represent it in thought is a simple impossibility. The will has no jurisdiction, because the subjects embraced are wholly beyond its province. This is implied in the very epithet by which this species of truth is signalized. It is very different with moral speculations. There, as every question has two sides, and the opposite of truth is always cogitable, the assent is not the product solely of the evidence, but of the evidence conjointly with the temper and disposition of the man. Two factors conspire in the production of the result. The mind not only receives the light, but changes and transforms it into its own image. The will, in its wide sense, enters as a powerful element, and puts its own interpretation upon the appearances submitted to the intellect. It does for the evidence what, according to the philosophy of Kant, the understanding does for the material of sensibility. It supplies the form. Hence, in moral and religious subjects, universal experience has demonstrated that a man, quote, understands as much by his affections as his reason, end quote. His beliefs are voluntary in the sense that they are largely determined by the active principles of his nature. Then again, there is an indirect and mediate power of the will by which, although we cannot immediately produce any given conviction or emotion, we can place ourselves in the circumstances in which the causes shall operate that are fitted to achieve the desired result. Upon these two grounds, we maintain that there may be a virtuous or a vicious exercise of the understanding, and that man is responsible for his opinions as he is responsible for the motives which impel him to intellectual effort and for the diligence, caution, and attention by which he avails himself of all the means of arriving at truth. I have designedly taken this wide circuit as preparatory to the illustrations which are yet to be presented, quote, of the nature of that veracity which is incumbent on us in our intercourse with our fellow creatures. The most solid foundation for the uniform and the scrupulous exercise of this virtue is to cherish the love of truth in general and to impress the mind with a conviction of its important effects on our own happiness and on that of society, end quote. If asked why the love of truth is a duty, I can only appeal to the dictates of conscience and the authority of God. It is worthy of remark, however, that no theory of morals has ever yet been ventilated, at all entitled to the respect of mankind, in which this virtue has not received a prominent position. Among the ancients, all virtue was a species of truth, and in the school of the Stagirite, prudence was an intellectual habit conversant about all practical, as wisdom was a habit conversant about all speculative truth. In the school of the Stoics, the importance which is attached to it may be seen from the offices of Tully, quote, of all the properties and inclinations of men there is none, quote, he informs us, quote, more natural and peculiar to them than an earnest desire and search after truth, end quote. And to this instinctive love of truth in general, he traces our approbation of frankness, candor, and sincerity in conduct. Among the Stoics, as among the Peripatetics, prudence as a cardinal virtue consisted in the contemplation and study of practical truth. The theory of Wollaston, to come down to modern times, confessedly resolves all virtue into truth, and the schemes of Clark, Cudworth, and Price presuppose the speculative conclusions of the intellect as the final basis of moral distinctions. If we place virtue in sentiment, there is nothing, according to the confession of all mankind, more beautiful and lovely than truth, more ugly and hateful than a lie. If we place it in calculations of expediency, nothing on the one hand is more conspicuously useful than truth and the confidence it inspires, nothing on the other more disastrous than falsehood, treachery, and distrust. If there be, then, a moral principle to which, in every form, humanity has given utterance, it is the obligation of veracity. Truth is alike the perfection of the intellect and the glory of the heart. The gospel, it has been beautifully said, quote, divides universal virtue into two cardinal, collateral, and coexistent branches, truth and charity, the foundation and consummation of all things, corresponding to the two constituent parts of human nature, the intellect and the will, those singular and supereminent distinctions by which man becomes a subject of a religion which makes him wise unto salvation, end quote. The practical conclusion which I am anxious to impress upon you from this part of the subject is the obligation of making truth for its own sake the great end of your intellectual efforts. It is a principle which requires to be strengthened by exercise and matured into a habit. The discipline of the mind is imperfect, however fully its various capacities have been developed, until the love of truth gains the ascendancy which is due to it as the supreme and sovereign law of thought. Various motives may prompt us to be diligent and patient in the acquisition of knowledge. Some seek it, as Butler has caustically suggested, merely for the sake of talking, or to qualify themselves for the world, some for their own entertainment, some for one purpose, others for another. But multitudes have no sort of curiosity to see what is true. There are subordinate ends which are lawful, but they must always be kept in subserviency to the love of truth for itself. What an influence it would exert upon all who are engaged in intellectual pursuits if they were pervaded in the whole soul with this pure and sacred love of knowledge! What student could indulge in indolence, or turn to his lessons as a weary task, or immerse himself in habits which dim the understanding, if he felt in any just proportion to the real state of the case the transcendent excellence of truth, or the loathsome deformity of error? Let us rise to the dignity of this high argument. We have minds that were made to know. We are constructed with a reference to truth, and we are called upon to purge and unscale our sight at the fountain itself of heavenly radiance. The streams of science are flowing at our feet, and the food which angels eat is offered to our palate. Let it never be said that we have neglected these golden opportunities and turned from the temple of truth to worship at the shrine of ignorance, error, and shame. Resolve in the strength of God this day that, like Isis in search of the mangled body of Osiris, you will go up and down, gathering limb by limb the scattered fragments of truth as your circumstances shall enable you to find them. This love of truth, which I have been endeavoring to recommend, will be of the very last importance to you to guard you against the deceits of the world. Man walketh in a vain show, untutored by experience. The young, particularly, are slow to suspect that the prospects of good, of pleasure, opulence, and power which stretch in rich luxuriance before them are an empty pageant. Unskilled in the treachery of the heart and the wiles of the tempter, they can hardly be persuaded that the gilded colors in which imagination adorns the future are only a splendid drapery under which are concealed disappointment, sorrow, and vexation. They have yet to learn the emptiness of pleasure, the agonies of power, and the vanity of wealth. Impetuous in their passions, ardent in their temper, and ignorant of life, they are prone to fix their affections upon some of those beggarly elements which will crumble into ashes at the touch of experience. The prince of darkness, intent upon their ruin, plies his fatal arts of enchantment to lull them into a sleep of false security, to exclude religion from their thoughts, and to conduct them by deceitful promises of good, by lies congenial with his nature, to the shades of death. This is a position of immense peril. The world, the flesh, and hell all conspire by glozing falsehood to seduce us to perdition. A covering is spread upon the grave and the pit, and the ways of sin are adorned with all that can please the eye, fascinate the ear, or enchant the heart. Our security against these dangers is conviction of the truth, the Word of God, which is preeminently the truth, and in which a truth-loving heart will lead us to rest, dissipates the spell, reveals the snare, and delivers from the plot. It paints life in its true colors, tears the mask from the face of guilt, disrobes the world of its gorgeous drapery, and points to him who is emphatically the way, the truth, and the life. All the rays of moral truth ultimately center in the cross of the Redeemer, and we never reach the summit of wisdom until we attain that life, which is alike the knowledge of the Father and of His Son, Jesus Christ. Everyone, says the Savior, that is of the truth heareth my voice. None perish but those who love darkness rather than light. A deceived heart turns them aside.
For more information about Antioch Presbyterian Church, please visit antiochpca.com.